Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In 1969, Eric Idle shot to fame as a founding member of Monty Python, the British sketch comedy troupe whose flying circus created a cascade of characters spouting off about spam and lumberjacks and dead parrots. For example, here's Idle as Mr. Smoke Too Much, looking to book a trip at a travel agency.
Being herded into endless hotel Miramars and Bellevues and Bontin and Tars with their international luxury modern roomettes and their Watney's Red Barrel and their swimming pools full of fat German businessmen pretending to be acrobats and forming pyramids and frying the children and barging into the queues. And if you're not at your table spot on seven, you miss your bowl of Campbell's cream and mushroom soup, the first item on the menu of international cuisine.
Now, I could never tell if the Pythons perfectly channeled British absurdism or their propensity for what one brilliant observer once called joyless hedonism, or maybe it was both. But the TV show turned into a phenomenon and led to adored films such as Monty Python and the Holy Grail and The Life of Brian, not to mention legions of obsessive fans. But almost 50 years later, Idle is out with a new sorta biography, as he calls it. So this hour on Point, Eric Idle on why he's still looking on the bright side of life. And you can join us. What is it about Monty Python's humor, if you were a fan, that stays with you? What impact do you see the Pythons having on comedy today, or how has comedy changed? What's your question for Eric Idle? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, Eric Idle joins us today from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. His new book is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Yeah, it is the same title as his famous song, and you can read an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Eric Idle, welcome to On Point.
Good morning, Meghna.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. Now, let me first ask you, I have read that even though next year marks the 50th anniversary of the Pythons, you don't find reason to celebrate. Why is that?
Well, we shall celebrate. We'll celebrate. I just don't think we all do very much work. we should be stopping now, I think. We should be allowed to have some time off. But we'll have something. We will be announcing something in about a couple of months, I think.
Okay.
But it won't be us all getting together and doing sketches again, because half of us are dead and the other half of us have forgotten who we are. So it'll be a gentle, nudge from retirement.
All right. Well, so let us then take a look back, as you do in your book, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And we'll talk about the song in a minute here. But I feel like I just want to ask, first of all, a basic question that popped into my mind when I read a paragraph early on in the book. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read it here. You write that as a child, that you were fairly funny at school, and humor is a good defense against bullying. It's hard to hit a smaller boy when you are laughing. I got used to dealing with gangs of males and getting on with life in unpleasant circumstances while being smart at the expense of authority. Perfect training for Python. Now, you were the small boy that you're referencing there in your British boarding school, but how many of the Pythons had the same sort of rough childhood experience?
I don't think they had it quite as rough. I know that John Cleese was at a sort of semi-public school, a public school at Clifton. Michael was at a sort of public school, I think, in Shrewsbury. And the other two were at grammar schools, what were called grammar schools in those days. And, of course, Terry Gilliam, being American, had no education whatsoever.
And so then let's talk a little bit more about the specifics of what you write about in your early life here. I mean, your school experience, shipped off to boarding school at the age of seven. I mean, it sounds terrible.
Yes, it was pretty terrible. I mean, it is in a place called Wolverhampton, which is not quite the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And it sort of was really, it was rather rough. You know, it was like a Dickensian boarding school. There was a dormitory 100 yards long. The prefects could beat you with slippers, and the masters had the privilege of beating you with canes. But there was quite a lot of beating, one way or another. And, I was there 12 years. You know, I mean, you get less for murder. But since then, I've come, you know, at my advanced age, I sort of realised that it prepared me very much for life. Not necessarily a very good life, but it certainly taught one how to deal with strange and rough and tough situations. And that's quite useful in the film business.
Yeah. Well, I like the idea of that it prepared you for being smart at the expense of authority, because you talk about how one of the ways that you made the older boys laugh is when they would beat you with their sticks and they would say, it's for your own good. And you, how would you respond?
Well, why don't I do it for you then? You know, I mean, yes, it was mainly the masters would say that. I mean, boys didn't have the amount of hypocrisy that masters did. But yes, it was, you know, they're keeping discipline in a boarding school. That's the way they did it since the 17th century. So I think it no longer happens anymore.
Yeah.
Character building, I think they call it.
The reason why I'm asking you about this is, I mean, it's where you open the book, but I also am always curious with comedians, like, where does this relentless drive to challenge authority come from, to be constantly funny in the face of, or to engage with darkness with humor? And it sounds like it came from deep places in your childhood.
Well, psychologists say, and this is what they say, that it comes from mother abandonment. But I haven't read too deeply on that, and that would work in my case, and it works in quite a lot of comedians' cases. I mean, it's quite something to be out there looking for love and affection from a lot of strangers in a dark room. You know, I mean, it's kind of, you know, that thriving on a laugh is a vital spark. I think you become a kind of surf junk, you know, a laugh junkie, and you need that. I mean, you go for that big belter. I certainly like that. It's a reaffirmation. When I've just been on a book tour of three different countries, and each time you want those laughs, you know.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us a little bit about what happened to your father that sort of precipitated the fact that you did later on end up going to this boarding school?
Yeah, I mean, it was very ironic, really. My father was in the RAF in World War II, and he'd been in the RAF since 1941. And the war was over, and they were told to hitchhike home because everybody stopped for the forces. And he was hitchhiking home on the back of a lorry, and it was involved in an accident, and he died in hospital on Christmas Eve. So I was about 2.5, so it wasn't, you know, the reaction was more like my mother's abandonment, and she went very strange and withdrew, you know, into sort of semi-madness, I think. And so you don't really know what goes on. You learn from other relatives what was at that sort of age. You don't have much memory of these things directly. But then, you know, then the RAF paid for my education. They put me in this boarding school, so it was very nice of them. And I had a fairly decent education. It meant I was good enough to get into Cambridge, which was really a great break.
Yeah. So I'm seeing that. I can't tell if it's because you're British or because do you have a naturally sunny disposition? Because it seems as if, regardless of what had happened to you as a child, you do always look back and are looking on the bright side of life.
Well, I think that's true. I think I found that when I was writing the book. It was called, when I was working on it first, it was called Say No More, which I decided I'd put on my tombstone instead. I think that it's, when I look back, I think, yes, look at this. Well, of course you had to look on the bright side. And I think it was sort of a coming out of a wartime situation. There were all those songs around that time of looking on the bright side, the bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover, one day it will all be over. And so my song, Always Look on the Bright Side, is a kind of parody of those sort of wartime, cheery-uppy kind of songs. And it was written specifically to be crucified to. Can't say that about many other songs.
Yeah.
But
This is what's so wonderfully challenging about the Python's humor is I don't feel like I should really laugh when someone says this song was meant to be crucified to, and yet one can't help it.
It's like that was a form of execution. I mean, if he'd been hanged, they'd all be walking around with nooses around their necks. You know, I mean, it's just a form of execution. 2,000 slaves were crucified along the Appian Way, you know, at the time of the uprising, of the slave uprising. There's nothing specifically. It was just the Roman method of public execution.
Yeah.
So all our characters were heading for that in our movie, The Life of Brian. And so I suggested we should end with a song. Seems very appropriate to me.
Well, we're gonna talk more about that song in just a minute here. But I wanted to ask you though, at what point in time? You write about this in the book, but tell us a story about the point in time where you realized that this ability that you had formed in your boarding school to use humor as a force of power and even a weapon in the world, that you thought, wait a minute, I could do this as a career.
Well, it sort of happened at Cambridge when almost the first person I met was John Cleese, mm-hmm. and I was doing a piece of his material. And I joined this organization called the Footlights Club, which was in Cambridge University and had been going since 1883. And, it allowed only men to join. And so when I became president, I changed the rules. And my little radical left-wing English boy from the north of England, I permitted women to join. And ironically, the very first woman who came and joined was Germaine Greer.
Huh.
Who wrote, you know, The Female Eunuch,
right.
Which again was ironic because she had the biggest balls of any woman I've ever met. So.
Well, Eric Idle, stand by here for just a second. We are speaking with one of the founding members of Monty Python, Eric Idle. He has a new book out. It's a sort of biography, as he calls it. It's called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And we're going to go into the break here listening to Galaxy Song from The Meaning of Life. And we'll take some of your questions for Eric Idle when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
I'm moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Eric Idle. He is one of the founders of Monty Python, and he has a new book. He calls it a sorta biography. It's called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And Eric, if I may, I want to play one of the more famous or most famous clips from Monty Python's Flying Circus. This is the sketch famously known as Nudge Nudge, in which you play a character who sits a little too close to another pub patron. That patron is played by Terry Jones, and your character fires off a series of rapid questions. It goes on for a while, but we just want to play. Here's the beginning.
You married?
Yes.
I'm a bachelor myself. Is your wife a goer? Eh? Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge, know what I mean? Say no more.
Beg your pardon?
Your wife, Does she go, eh? Out of me. Does she go, eh?
She sometimes goes.
I bet she does. Say no more. Know what I mean? Nudge.
That's Eric Idle in the Nudge Nudge sketch from Monty Python's Flying Circus. Tell us about the creation of this sketch. How did it come about?
Well, it was an awfully long time ago, but the most interesting thing for me is that the biggest fan of that sketch was Elvis Presley. And he would call everybody Squire because of that. And when I found that out, my life was made because I was a huge Elvis fan. And I just couldn't believe that he would do that. Hey, everybody, hey, Squire. You know, so... and he would also do... Linda Thompson told me this. She was his penultimate lady. And she said Elvis would make her sit up in bed at 2 a.m. and do Monty Python sketches. And not any. He would do our what we call pepper pots. So the old ladies go, hello, Mrs. Thing. Hello, Mrs. Entity. How are you then? And I just can't really get the visual of that.
You know, Elvis Presley.
It's the wider that. Elvis sitting up in bed with Linda Thompson, screaming at each other, looking for a new brain. I just think that's so wonderful. You can't write that stuff, can you?
No. And if you did, people would probably think...
Wouldn't believe you.
No. I mean, but doesn't it speak... It speaks to... The bizarre universality of the Python's comedy, which it doesn't seem to make sense to me because it is so British as well. I mean, how would you describe what the Pythons did?
Well, I think it's kind of encyclopedic comedy. I mean, it only appears to be one show. It's got lots of, you know, we write differently. Each of us write differently. And it's all apparently linked together by these little animations of Gilliam. So it makes it look like it's about something. But really, there's many different forms of humour. So while we'd often find people would enjoy it, we could never find whether they'd agree about which bits they'd enjoyed. So,
and so what?
Well, I think there's nothing really. There is a sort of attitude. I suppose there's an attitude which is to mess around with the show itself, and to recognise it's only a show, and to play with the audience's expectations. And I think that's what we did with the most fun. We had messing with them. I mean, we put out a 3-sided album once, which they. Some people still didn't find the third side for about 2 months, and then they really nearly fall off their seats. You know, what the hell's this? So we did like to play with them a lot.
Well, listen, you've got legions of fans who are flooding our phone lines here, so let me let some of them in. Nathan is calling from Cody, Wyoming. Nathan, you're on the air with Eric Idle.
Great segment, Megan. Mr. Idle, I had two questions. The first one is a show that preceded your Monty Python was a show called Doctor in the House. Did you have any involvement with that show?
Not at all. In fact, I took a vow never to watch it. It was written actually by John Cleese and Graham Chapman, who, of course, you know, John will do anything for money. So, but it was quite funny, I believe. But no is the answer. I had nothing to do with it. Honest, I promise.
Nathan, do you have a follow-up question for Eric Idle?
The next question is, one of the funniest bits that you guys did was a segment called The Ministry of Silly Walks.
Yes.
How did that come about?
I think Michael Palin wrote it. And with Terry Jones, and John Cleese played it because John could move in the most extraordinary way. Unless he can't do it anymore because of age, he has a silly walker now. So, but you know, it was. I thought it's almost a balletic performance. It's really funny. But what's funny about it is that they take it perfectly seriously. The minister is complaining they don't have enough money to keep. To me, it illustrates that sort of wonderful Python way of just taking a really absurd idea but treating it completely seriously.
Yeah. Can we step back in time a little bit, Eric Idle, because we can and will talk a lot more about the impact and influence that Python has had on subsequent generations of comedians. But I'm not yet through understanding sort of your inspirations here, because you write in the book specifically about a moment in time for you where you say, after this point, you could not conceive of life without comedy. And that's when you saw Beyond the Fringe with Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Alan Bennett in the early 1960s. Tell us a little bit about that.
was about 1962, and they were Cambridge and Oxford Review, and they came from the Edinburgh Festival, hence the Fringe reference, and they were just hilarious. Peter Cook was probably the funniest man in the world. And I had never seen anything like this. And they attacked the monarchy and the forces and the war, and they mocked everything of British life. And it was just so refreshing. It was like a complete they wiped the blackboard, and I just rolled around the floor laughing. I just thought, I didn't know you were allowed to do that. And after that, I didn't want to do anything else. I learned the album, and I just wanted to be funny after that.
You learned the album. You memorized the album.
Yeah, I memorized all the bits and Alan Bennett bits, and it was game changing, and it changed England too, because it brought a satire boom into England, and Peter Cook would mock the Prime Minister, which is Harold Macmillan, and they actually changed the government. Because he was now an object of ridicule. And it shows you how powerful comedy is. I mean, we see it today, you know, how important it is to people to deal with unpleasant realities by using comedy.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We actually went back and grabbed one moment from Beyond the Fringe. This is from the stage review performed in London in 1961. It did actually and then move to Broadway. This is an early part. And I have to say, Eric, when I watched it, I thought, my God, if it hadn't been for the black and white film I was watching, it could have been filmed yesterday, because there was a timelessness to it. We picked a part where Alan Bennett, Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, and Dudley Moore's in this scene as well. They are discussing America and talking about the Statue of Liberty being the beginning of an American downfall.
I'm idealistic, Johnny. Went and inscribed on the bottom all this business about give me your poor, your huddled masses. Well, of course, people did. The huddled masses leapt at the opportunity. They came over in droves.
Bred like rabbits, died like flies.
And spread like wildfire. The whole place was swamped.
That's from Beyond the Fringe in 1961. What do you think hearing that today?
I think that it's interesting, because I never heard that sketch, and I think it must have been one they wrote when they were in America, because it addresses, you know, deliberately addresses the American audience and is about America. But they were so clever. I mean, they were really funny. And they were certainly my inspiration.
Right.
That and a radio show called The Goons, who were very surreal, had Peter Sellers in. And
Spike Milligan, right?
And Spike Milligan, indeed. And they were really surreal, because it was all radio, so they could have sketches about the Thames being set on fire. And you could do that on radio. You can't film that, but still.
Well, this idea of, as you write the book, everything that you secretly hated was being mocked and doing so wittily. Is that – did you take that into the writing that you did for Python?
Well,
subversiveness?
This is quite a long bit from that. I mean, 3 years of doing comedy at Cambridge, you learn your art. We used to go and do cabaret up and down the country and perform in front of people. And so you learn your trade. And then after that, I wrote for a radio show they were all in. And then I wrote for a television show called The Frost Report. So we'd all done our Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours by the time we were together. You know, we'd reached the tipping point. And when we were given our own show, we were perfectly capable of wreaking mayhem in it, because we knew not what we wanted to do, but what we wanted to avoid.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to be nice and smart and smile and say, and now something completely different. You know, we use the BBC's own continuity phrase against them.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but speaking of that, you write about in the book how one of the things that you think made the Flying Circus so successful was that you actually, even though you were doing it under the auspices of the BBC, you had relatively free rein. Is that right?
We had totally free rein. They were opening up a Sunday night slot and they didn't really care. They just felt people were coming back from the pubs and would watch television, and they were right. And they faced us, you know, and it was kind of a perfect match. And the BBC in those days, I used to call it executive-free comedy because they wouldn't either read the scripts or interfere with us or watch it even. So they defended us. They, if the people complained, they said, all right, it's just all sorts of things, you know. And we were very, very fortunate to have three series without any interference whatsoever.
It sounds almost unimaginable today.
It isn't unimaginable because, you know, there's too much executives in comedy.
So do you think that that's something Python-esque? I mean, not obviously not a copy or a descendant of, but the kind of creative freedom. Because if it's lacking now, will we get brilliant comedy shows?
No, you get brilliant. There's plenty of brilliant comedy, and there's even plenty of brilliant group comedy and sketch comedy. Sketch comedy went out, really, though it was replaced by stand-up and. So, you know, I mean, it's sort of making its way back a little bit, I think. But I think you'll always get bands of people being funny. They were back in Shakespeare's time. They were called the University Wits. They were still doing the same material, I think. I bet you they were doing the parrot sketch. Mine, well, parrot hath no life.
Well, let's go to a caller. Let's go to Bruce, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi there. This is just a deep appreciation to you, Mr. Idle, and your friends. Mr. Bouvier, our English teacher in suburban Connecticut, mid-70s, said, kids, you got to watch this show. In fact, I'm assigning it. And we would have to go home, watch the show, and we came back, and we would regurgitate entire sketches over and over. It's almost like the way my father might have learned, you know, poetry. We were learning how to memorize, and your comedy is so word intensive that I really owe my ability to memorize anything, I think, to you guys.
What was Mr. Bouvier supposedly teaching you? What was his discipline?
I believe it was English.
English, okay. Well, that's anything, isn't it?
Yeah,
yes, no, it is appropriate. Yeah. Sometimes people got it, they got history done a lot through the Holy Grail, and other people get, now they got religion done through Brian, which is kind of interesting. And philosophy, we have a philosopher's song, which is also very useful for people getting through philosophy 101. I think we just should become a big university, I think.
Python University.
Yeah, Python University. Why not? If Trump tried it, you know, at least we'd, you know, get a good laugh.
Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Well, you know, Bruce talked about the word intensivity of or intensiveness of your comedy. I want to just play a clip from Life of Brian, the 1979 movie in which Brian, played by Graham Chapman, you know, it has to do with the life of Jesus as well. But in this scene in particular, Brian gets a Latin grammar lesson from a centurion played by John Cleese because Brian has just been caught leaving graffiti on a wall. And when the centurion finds him out, he expects that he's going to lose his life.
Aeunt? What is aeunt? Go. Conjugate the verb to go. It is aeunt.
So aeunt is?
Third person plural present indicative. They go.
But Romans go home is an order, so you must use the...
imperative.
Which is?
How
many Romans?
Derek Idle, I have never taken a Latin lesson in my entire life, and I remember the first time I saw it, my sides were split.
Oh, that's good, because actually John was spent 2 years teaching Latin at his old prep school. He went back as a teacher. So he is literally just doing a Latin lesson. I had to study Latin, so I remember it well. But I'm glad that you laugh without not knowing Latin. That's good to know.
Well, it's the absurdity of a centurion, you know, as Brian is right to think, you know, he's going to get killed in Roman Judea by the centurion. And instead it devolves or evolves, I can't tell, into a Latin grammar lesson. I mean, that's the classic Python twist.
He makes him write it out 100 times on the wall, too, which is very silly. It's exactly the opposite of what he's trying to do.
Well, let's get another call in here before we have to take another quick break here. Peg is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Peg, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm an enormously huge fan from many years back. And speaking of Python University, when I was in school, in New York State. My acting teacher used to play us his preciously hoarded video cassette tapes of Monty Python. And these were sort of teaching tools, because when we would have to do some play and we had to do some regional dialect from the British Isles, you know, the professor would choose some sketch and say, all right, well, this is from Northumbria, or this is Cockney, or what have you. And it was not only hilariously funny for us, but we would get sort of a culture lesson as well, because then my professor, Terry Brown, would then also explain, well, the reason they use this expression or the reason they talk like this would be this. So my question is, on top of that comment, is were there ever any particular dialects or voices or accents that you or any of your compatriots found especially challenging to do?
I don't know. I think there's a bit of a parrot in, certainly in me. If I'm talking to Billy Connolly, for example, I'll end up talking like this to Billy. You know, I just happen to slip into it, you know, quite easily. So I think we enjoyed playing all of those different accents. England is absolutely packed with them, and they have different socio-economic implications too about what level of society they're in. I think it was useful. It was fun.
Yeah. Well, we are talking with Eric Idle. He's one of the founders of Monty Python. His new book, he calls it a sort of biography, is called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And we're going to take a quick break here. You're hearing the music from Find Your Grail. That's from the musical Spamalot, which Eric Idle wrote as well. We'll take more calls when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. When there's nothing you can't do.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Eric Idle. He is, of course, one of the founding members of Monty Python, and he has a new book out. It's a sort of biography, as he likes to call it. It's called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And Eric, if I may, we have to play at least one clip from the 1974 film Monty Python and the Holy Grail, a classic of Monty Python comedy here. And so in this scene, happens to be one of my favorites. We're just going to play a part of it. King Arthur and his knights must cross a tattered rope bridge, but not before answering the bridge keeper's three questions. And again, they are on the quest for the Holy Grail. So here is the character of Sir Robin, played by you, Eric Idle. And Sir Robin steps up thinking he's going to ace these three questions.
Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
What is your name?
Sir Robin of Camelot.
What is your quest?
To seek the Holy Grail.
What is the capital of Assyria?
I don't know that.
Of course, for those who have seen the movie, the scene goes on to the apex of an airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow. So let's go to Kate, who is calling from South Berwick, Maine. Kate, are you a fan of Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Hi, yes, I'm a huge fan, and I distinctly remember in high school in the 80s when my group of friends would just repeat all the lines from Holy Grail, and now that I'm 50, we recently watched Holy Grail with my son, who's almost 12, and he loved every minute of it. He started to repeat. He wants to watch it over and over again and repeat the lines. And it's just so great that over these decades that it is, you know, the humor is one that resonates with kids my son.
I think it is. Do you know why? I think it's because kids see adults behaving like children, pretending to ride horses, which is what they do. So I think they feel very comfortable.
With coconut shells going clippity-clop.
Yeah, with coconut shells going clippity-clop. But we are actually currently setting up to make a movie of Spamalot, which at least is based on the Grail. So that's what we're doing at the moment. So we've got coconuts on our minds all over the place here.
Well, let's get another call here about Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Tess is calling from Jamestown, New York. Tess, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mr. Idle, I have to thank you. I honestly haven't seen Holy Grail probably since I was 16 or 17. But I work for the U.S. Army Chaplain Corps, and to this day, I have a hand grenade case that has embroidered on it the holy hand grenade, and the internal compartments are 1, 2, and 5.
And that's very funny.
It's so amazing that a film that I probably haven't seen in 15 or 20 years still has that kind of impact on me. So I wanted to thank you for all the sketches you put out with Juan.
You're very welcome. It is bizarre, I grant you. But it just goes on. I find it really amazing. It's 40 years next year that film since the film was released, and it still plays away happily, and Spamalot is touring America again, and, you know, it's as I say, we're making a movie of it. So the Holy Hand Grenade will be being made again.
And to think it actually has a place of hallowed respect in the U.S. Army Chaplain's Corps.
I love that.
But more so because, as you write in the book, at the first public screening of Holy Grail, it was actually a total disaster. Is that right? In London?
Well, it was a tryout screening. Okay. I mean, people hadn't paid. It was the first, we have a tryout screening. And it was for many of our investors. And it was an absolute disaster. And that's because you don't get things right when you make a movie. You have to try and drag the movie into where the audiences begin to laugh and keep them laughing. And so it took us a while to get that done on Grail. We had to throw out the soundtrack because it was ruining all the jokes. And we ended up with 12 or 13 cuts before we actually got it to where we felt it was funny enough. And we even shot little bits to segue between bits that weren't really working.
Oh, wow. So
there's an art to it. It's like a theorem, I think. You know, A plus B will equal laughter if you get it right.
Yeah. Well, an art and a practice as well. I'm just curious. It is so wonderful to hear that these many years later, I mean, we have callers who have these incredibly fond memories of the early Python sketches, of the movies as well. And, you know, obviously you're speaking to an American audience here. But I'm wondering, what do you think, why do you think it connected beyond the UK? Or perhaps a different way of asking is, are there critical differences between American and British comedy?
I think that's harder to answer. But yeah. I think the one thing we were certain of is it would never go in America. We were absolutely confident of that, and we were completely and utterly wrong. I'm very grateful. But we were picked up by PBS, which is very fortunate for us. In Dallas was the first PBS station to play it. And then they sold it to a few other stations like New York. And suddenly people were watching this thing late on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
And it was a perfect storm because then we opened the Holy Grail. And we were actually, it was a bit like Beatlemania. We were trapped in a cinema in New York all day while they had screenings. And we had to sign coconuts. It was very odd
why
and bizarre.
But why were you so confident that it wouldn't work in America?
Because we felt it was, for all the reasons you said, it was very English. They had English place names. They seemed to be about English types. But then I think one learns that, in fact, now we know it goes to 98 countries, that the human being is the same in every country. We have the same angers and, you know, the same problems and the same issues. So if you get it right for one society, it transposes itself.
Yeah. Well, forgive me for doing that. I just wanted to, before we move on to talk more about other aspects of your career, I just wanted to get in one more Holy Grail clip here. And it's still reaching, as you're saying, it's still reaching new audiences 43 years after the original release. So here is a clip featuring Sir Robin, again played by you, Eric Idle, who disagrees with his portrayal. Medieval musicians are portraying him, and Sir Robin just really objects to it.
You're a knight of the round table?
I am. In that case, I shall have to kill you.
Shall I? Oh, I don't think so.
All right, we'll kill him first, and then have tea and biscuits.
Right. He's buggered off.
So he has, he's scarpered.
Brave Sir Robin ran away.
No!
Bravely ran away.
I didn't!
When danger reared its ugly head, he bravely turned his tail and said, brave Sir Robin turned about.
I didn't!
So Robin bravely ran away. Okay, let's go to Johnny, who is calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Johnny, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Eric, thank you for your creativity and dedication to crafting comedy and giving us the important medicine of laughter that's going to be archived for us for all time. Very much appreciate that. I do enjoy when watching Flying Circus, watching the corners of your mouths to see when somebody's going to break into laughter.
And you can find those moments. You can see such moments. You can find such moments.
Yeah.
There's a very, very good one when in the Holy Grail, John Cleese says, she turned me into a newt. And I'm standing in front of him, and he waits forever. And I go, I bite the scythe I'm holding. He says, I got better. Finally, he says that. But it's about the 12th take, and he's got longer and longer. And it was just, you know, anyway, occasionally you can't hold it, as they say.
Well, Johnny, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Alan, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi. I have to say that I have a terrific memory of you, Eric, and it was in person. I was on my way home from filming Popeye in Malta in 1981, I was in Venice, Italy, and I ran into you and Lorne Michaels and your respective wives or girlfriends. I was with my girlfriend. We repaired back to Lorne's room, and I have never laughed so much in my entire life.
Oh, I remember that, yes. Well, you were on Popeye, were you?
That's right. I was Roughhouse.
That's great, because I met Robin Williams when he came through London, having just finished shooting Popeye, and we became the best of friends from that.
We all took a route to see you.
Well, that's great. That's lovely.
Well, Eric, can you? This is a great segue. Can you tell us, because you write about your friendship with Robin Williams in the book. I mean, tell us more about first meeting him and the friendship that the two of you developed.
Well, I mean, I was told, somebody said, you should come and see this guy. He's really funny. So I went down to Soho, and there was a very drunken audience, and they were screaming and shouting and being very obnoxious. And the host said, I have a secret weapon. And here he is, Robin Williams. And he threw Robin in, and Robin just took the place apart. I mean, he ended up by, there was a heckler, a persistent heckler, and he ended up by having the whole audience praying for the death of this heckler. And I've never seen anything like it. He was the fastest and the most brilliant comedian I've seen in my entire life. And he could just wing it and he could make it up. And I fell in love with him immediately, and we got to know each other very well. And I would follow him around California to later and later in the night as he'd go to these tiny little clubs, you know, looking for a new audience. And He was wonderful. I adored him. We went on many holidays together. He taught me the meaning of private jet lag, and we had really nice times.
Yeah. Well, his death must have hit you very hard then.
It was just intolerable. We were doing O2, our reunion show, and I was trying to get him to come on and be on it on the last night because we had a little guest slot, and he said, "No, I don't want to perform." I said, "Well, you don't have to perform. Just come and be with us, you know, because you're a fan." And then I had no really idea of just the dire straits he was in with the, you know, the disease he had, which is only turned up after the autopsy revealed that he had Lewy body's disease, which is incurable anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Eric, we have about 5 minutes left here in the program, and I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about where you see or how you see the Python's legacy when you look out at the world of comedy today. Where do you see the effects of what the Pythons did 50 years ago?
Well, I think like the Beyond the Fringe inspired us. We've inspired a generation of comics. I know that from people I knew, like Gary Shandling and Steve Martin and Robin Williams. They all love Python, Bill Murray's and Belushi and all of those people. So you just pass it on, really. But I think what is really weird and unnatural is that after 50 years, people should still be finding it funny. I find that's very much a tribute, I think, to our writing so much as our performing. We were, I think, rather good writers, and we were very good at constructing and criticizing our own writing, because it should no longer really be on Netflix and people still enjoying it. You know what I mean? It shouldn't be.
Yeah. Well, Neil Innes in 2009 on a BBC documentary said that you were the philosopher of the group, the one who really liked to deconstruct television, and that's what in part led to all that great writing.
Well, I think in the sense the subtext of the series is television. Yes, then it's all mocking television and interviewers and documentaries. And so, yes, I think that is correct, because we had, after all, just spent 4 or 5 years all writing for television and performing in television. So it was a new media. I mean, when we grew up, there was only radio. It didn't appear in England until we were 13 or 14. So I think we were obsessed by it and interested in it and used it. It was very useful for comedy.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, several years ago, I heard a phenomenal interview that Terry Gross, the host of NPR's Fresh Air, did with John Cleese. And he said, paraphrasing here, of course, that had it not been for comedy and for Monty Python, he feels like Monty Python saved his life, that he would have ended up in a depressed quotidian life, that he probably would have ended up taking his life. And he was serious when he said that. I mean, do you feel that somehow comedy definitely transformed your life? Did it save your life?
I don't know. I'm less of a depressive than I think John is. No, I mean, we all suffer from depressions at times. I'm more optimistic, and I also play the guitar, which keeps me cheered up, you know. I think that's possibly true. I think that John believes it to be true. I think, because that's the most extraordinary thing about John. He's very seemed to be on the surface straight-laced and very, you know, ordinary and sort of decent. But in fact, there's this manic person underneath who just laughs and laughs for 5 minutes. If you make him laugh, he'll lie on the floor, kicking his feet on the ground, howling with laughter. And that's really a great sight to see.
Yeah. Okay, so I have a favor to ask of you. You've been living in California for quite some time, so you are away from the United Kingdom as it's currently going through its Brexit upheavals. But I'm dying to know, what would Eric Idle write? What would be the Eric Idle sketch dealing with Brexit?
Well, I call it Dunkirk 2. We're running away from Europe, shooting ourselves in the foot, collapsing the entire economy, walking away from a game we were winning hands down, all because we have these dreadful newspapers run by very wealthy proprietors who don't live in the country and don't pay taxes there and do not wish to be subject to the healthcare requirements of Europe and the minimum wages and decent hours. So they have leaned on the Conservative Party to force us out of what we were doing very well at. And I think I'm happy I'm old now, because I think they really screwed it.
This sounds very serious. I didn't laugh then. Is it?
I'm sorry. I do beg your pardon. Well, it's. I think we'll all get a chance to laugh at England. I mean, well, people say, well, we have Trump. But you have Trump, but he doesn't last forever, whereas Brexit isn't going to change. And none of the parties represent the half of the populace who are against it. Neither of the parties represent them.
Well, Eric Idle, he's a founding member of Monty Python, the British comedy troupe. His new book is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. We're going to go out with, indeed, that very same song. Eric Idle, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Meg. No, it was fun.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Records available in the foyer. Someone's got to live as well, yeah. Who do you think pays for all this rubbish? Always look. I didn't make the money back, you know. I told him. I said to him, Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.